This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and I hope you had a good holiday. I want to talk to you about a legal and political issue that came up a few times during my Thanksgiving and might have been something that you've either thought about or been questioned about over the past few weeks. And that is President-elect Trump's proposed tariffs. And my bottom line here is you might want to wait before you rush out to stock up on goods that might be covered by President Trump's planned tariffs. Because while Trump has announced that he's going to impose sweeping tariffs on, quote, day one in office, there are still plenty of practical and legal hurdles for Trump to clear before those tariffs go into effect. I've written a little bit about this for MSNBC, so if you prefer the written form, you can go to that website as well. So let's assume for a moment that Trump is able to make good on his campaign promises and that he can impose tariffs on goods from, he's targeted these three countries, Mexico, Canada, and China. And then let's further assume that these tariffs, as many expect, might make our economy worse. What I want to offer for you is the blame does not fall just on the White House steps, but this is also Congress's fault, because for almost a century, Congress has ceded much of its constitutional authority to regulate in this area, to regulate foreign commerce. Congress, I would argue, has really abdicated much of its responsibility and allowed presidents to usurp this constitutional power and impose their will on global trading partners. This is, again, I'm offering for you, not what the founders intended. Under the Constitution, Congress has the power to regulate foreign commerce, including imposing tariffs. Those who drafted our Constitution envisioned a government of truly shared power between three co-equal branches. And sadly, I think in this area, meaning imposing tariffs and changing tariff rates, and in other areas, the legislative branch seems to have hobbled itself to the benefit of the executive branch. So, as I said, under the Constitution, let's always begin there, it's Congress, not the president, that has the power to regulate foreign commerce. But since the middle of the Great Depression, Congress has delegated much of that authority to the president. In 1934, Congress passed the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act that gave the president the power to negotiate trade agreements and make certain changes to U.S. tariff rates without congressional approval. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt thus became the first president to have the power to unilaterally alter tariffs. Fast forward almost three decades to 1962, Congress passes the Trade Expansion Act. And Section 232 of this act gives the president the power to change tariffs based on an investigation and determination by the Department of Commerce that some imports pose a national security threat. Now, during his first administration, Trump used this power much more liberally than his predecessors. And he twice imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum pursuant to his power under Section 232. Trump could use Section 232 again to impose tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada under the claim that immigrants and drugs flowing from those countries undermine our national security. Trump, of course, does say that the tariffs he proposes are a way to respond to the flow of fentanyl and other illegal drugs into the United States. But Trump can't, again, just wave a magic wand and use his 232 powers. He has to first direct the Department of Commerce to undertake an investigation. This is a process that typically takes months. In addition, while any legal challenges to Trump using this power would likely face an uphill battle, those seeking to undermine these tariffs, at least in a court of law, could try and show that imports from Mexico and Canada don't, in fact, pose a national security threat. Let's go further. Let's fast forward past that 1962 law. And now let's go to another congressional statute, again, giving the president more power in this area. So Congress, again, relinquishes its power over foreign commerce to the executive branch with the Trade Act of 1974. And Section 301 of that law gives the U.S. Trade Representative, who is a cabinet member, the power to impose trade sanctions on foreign countries when they do things like break trade agreements or harm U.S. commerce by taking actions that are viewed as unjustifiable or unreasonable. Trump could direct the Trade Representative to conclude that China has broken one or more trade agreements and therefore provide a pathway to impose sanctions, in this case tariffs, on goods imported from China. Here again, a challenger would likely face an uphill battle, but could allege that China didn't take actions that would justify the imposition of tariffs under that 1974 law. So let's talk a little bit more about these legal challenges. Now, in addition to challenges under domestic law, it's very possible that Trump's proposed tariffs could violate the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement that was negotiated during his first administration. But let's go back and really zero in on the domestic law challenges here. And I know I talked about a number of different statutes and sections, but let's be clear that I think the likely legal challenges here would be based on an argument that Trump stepped outside of his admittedly very broad authority that Congress granted the president. This type of challenge might gain new traction with the current court because it's embraced this doctrine called the major questions doctrine. And under this theory or doctrine, Congress has to provide clear authorization before an executive agency decides an issue of national significance with a big impact on the economy. What might that include? Something like imposing or altering tariffs, we can absolutely imagine falls within this bucket of issues that have a clear national significance and a significant impact on the economy. Now, history does indicate that courts will generally defer to the president when it comes to decisions in this area. But in addition to the major questions doctrine, there's been the end of another doctrine here, which I think could affect legal challenges. Specifically, in June of 2024, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote an opinion overturning the doctrine of Chevron deference. And Chevron deference basically said when there's a congressional statute and it's somewhat ambiguous, then courts should defer to an executive agency's interpretation. Chief Justice John Roberts, along with a majority of the court, overturned that ruling. That means courts should now exercise independent judgment and not defer to an executive agency when interpreting a congressional statute. This obviously would allow federal judges to perform a more searching review of the actions that Trump or any other president takes under congressional statutes authorizing him to do things like impose tariffs. Now, we've talked about the major questions doctrine. We've talked about the end of Chevron deference. Here's one more for you. There's a somewhat related legal challenge, and that would be that Congress has simply ceded too much authority to the president. The Constitution, as we've said, gives this power to regulate foreign commerce to Congress. And then 150 years later, after the Constitution is written, Congress has really given this power away decade after decade. And there's an argument that under the non-delegation doctrine, Congress can't delegate this power. They can't simply throw up their hands and say, here, now, President, you get to act. Again, I think this is an uphill battle, but it is one interesting legal theory. So all of this is to say, there are some serious practical and legal hurdles before President Trump is able to impose these proposed tariffs. Now, the best solution may not be to rely on the judiciary and federal judges. What I would offer is the best solution is for Congress to reassert its constitutional authority and revoke some of the power that is given away to the president. So I hope that helps you think through this big question of what's going to happen with respect to proposed tariffs. And I'm actually going to cover another topic quickly. And that's because since I recorded what you just listened to, there's been breaking news about President Biden deciding to pardon his son, Hunter Biden. And I want to talk briefly about those pardons and legally what they mean and a very little bit politically what they mean. So the first thing I want to say is that the Constitution gives presidents and presidents alone broad and exclusive discretion to provide pardons. And the purpose was so that the president could essentially act as a safety guard or a fail-safe, meaning if somebody had been convicted of a federal crime, for instance, and the president felt that the sentence was too harsh, maybe it's a low-level drug offender, for instance, the president can step in and say, I'm head of the executive branch. This person was charged by the executive branch, and I'm now going to say, no, the punishment does not fit the crime. So again, this is a situation where the Constitution says that it's only presidents who can act to provide pardons. And there really aren't any limitations on this power other than that the president has to act with respect to a federal crime, not a state crime. When it comes to state crimes, it's only the governors who have power in those situations. The other thing here is that pardons are not something that the next president can undo. This is a question I've gotten a lot over the past few days. And Congress and judges have no say when it comes to the granting of pardons. Now, most pardons that are granted by a president go through a process in the White House where there are attorneys who review these pardon requests and they say to the president, we recommend that you grant clemency or a pardon to these individuals, and here are their stories, and here is why we think that they are deserving. The pardons that tend to grab legal attention don't fall into that category. Instead, the pardons that fall within the category of those that I would talk about in this podcast are those that are politically charged, let's say. And that brings us, I think, to Hunter Biden. Obviously, the son of the president, he was convicted in one case dealing with buying a gun and lying on a federal form, and he pled guilty in another case dealing with tax evasion. Hunter Biden, as a result of these pardons, is now free and clear when it comes to any criminal acts that are covered by the timeframe that were listed in the pardon. The Trump Department of Justice cannot go after him for any facts that are falling within that timeframe. However, they can try to look for other potential wrongdoing by Hunter Biden, but there might be statute of limitations issues related to other conduct. Now, a big question that I've gotten a number of different times in a number of different ways regarding these pardons is, does this set a precedent? And my answer is not really. This precedent has already been set that presidents, particularly two-term presidents or one-term presidents who have lost their reelection bids, that on their way out the door, that's the moment when they tend to make politically unpopular pardons. For instance, Bill Clinton pardoned his brother at the end of his second term. Trump granted clemency to his son-in-law's father, Charles Kushner, who he now plans to appoint to be ambassador to France. And in fact, while overall Trump actually granted fewer pardons than his predecessors, he granted a greater percentage of pardons to people that he knew. So it certainly is the case that there is historical precedent for presidents, again, as the door is about to shut on their way out, saying to family, friends, benefactors, donors, here is a pardon or a grant of clemency. Not always, not all the time, but there is precedent for it. Now, the last question I've gotten a lot is, does this now open the door for President Trump in his second term to say that, look, President Biden granted his son a pardon, so now either it shows that the Department of Justice is just weaponized against people because President Biden said his son was unfairly selected for prosecution, and or does it now allow Trump to do something like pardon all of those who've been convicted or and pled guilty for the events surrounding January 6th. And my big take here is that I don't think President Trump was waiting for and looking for an opening. I think he, as our incoming president, has the power to grant pardons, and he will use it when he wants to, separate and apart from anything that President Biden has done. This does bring up the question of President Biden saying that Hunter Biden was the subject or the victim of selective prosecution. And here I do want us to separate those two cases. When it comes to the gun case, specifically that case dealt with lying on a federal form to purchase a gun. And that is a situation where we really very, very, very rarely see anybody prosecuted for that crime as a standalone crime the way Hunter Biden was. So we can have a legitimate conversation about selective prosecution. Having said that, a jury did find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But when it comes to the tax evasion case, I think that the calculus is somewhat different. And we obviously do see tax evasion charges that have been brought against people, and this is not unusual. Now, I think what President Biden would say is that his son had a target on him. And while it might be the case that Hunter Biden had a spotlight that was on him and that people looked into his background and his taxes in a way that they would not have if he were not the president's son, once alleged wrongdoing is uncovered, there's really no obligation to say, well, we won't move forward because we wouldn't have discovered this if this were Hunter Smith, not Hunter Biden. So that's a quick recap of some of the legal and political issues surrounding this pardon. I hope it answers some of your questions, and we'll be back next week with a lot more.